We left off with an example of equilibrium. We had this fire person standing on a ladder, and we were given the weight of the ladder, the weight of the person, right? Assuming that the ladder is uniform and the weight is concentrated at its center of mass, the person is 6.3 meters up the ladder. We indicated what the forces were. As you recall, the wall's pushing horizontally. The ground is pushing up. There's a frictional force down here. Normally, we assume that the wall is smooth so that we don't have to add any additional frictional forces at the top. Okay, so that's where we got to. As you recall, if I want to talk about equilibrium, we have two things to talk about. The sum of the forces is zero, and the sum of the torques is zero. And so the first is the net force is zero. In the examples we did before this, all the forces were vertical. In this example, we have some vertical forces and some horizontal forces. So we have to look at different components. So let's see the x component of all of our forces. By now, we ought to be able to recognize that when we have forces that are horizontal or vertical, we can quickly write down the components. When we come over here, we look at this g and the two weights have no x component. The only x component will come from the frictional force between the ladder and the ground and the normal force between the ladder and the wall. N is pointing to the left, F is pointing to the right. So if I look at the x components, we basically have that F should be equal to N. All right, in order for the total to be zero. And those are magnitudes, right? There's no arrows on them. Well, that doesn't do much for us because F and N are both unknowns. Right? One equation, two unknowns, and so we have to get more information. And then the Y components, let's look at the Y components. The other three forces have Y components, right? G, which is up. And we have two downward weights, so the total downward force should be equal to the upward force, right? So the total downward force, we just add the two weights, so it's going to be the sum of 875 and 375 if I add those two weights. Okay? What's that add up to? 1250. Okay, there's a type of the equation that you like to solve, right? Because it's automatic. Yes. Yesterday it was 355. Today it's 355, so I can't read.
1230.
Yeah, this is 355. So, that's 1230. But the point is that we know the downward weights, so we can solve for G. We still don't know F and N. So what do? We need another equation. So what's the other equation that we need to get? The net torque is equal to zero. This is where all the work comes in, is computing the net torque. So we have to compute the torques. Again, it's going to be force times moment arm for each force. Before computing the torque, what do I need to find or determine or state? What do I have to indicate before I compute the torque?
Where the center of mass is.
Axis. I need to determine where the rotation axis is. So I need to find a point about which things can rotate. Where would you put the axis?
On
Well, I have a couple of different places. Notice I have two unknowns here where the ladder hits the ground. This would be a nice place to put my axis of rotation. Right? As if the ladder were swinging about it. And sometimes that's even natural because some ladders have little feet, right, which the ladder can swing about so it can sit a little flatter on the ground. Again, we can pick our axis in different places. Did anybody go back and check the other problem and put the axis for the diver in a different place and see if we got the same answer? We have a couple of people that didn't do that. All right, so I have to compute the net torque. I'm going to compute it about this point. Again, why do I pick this? Because the torque due to these two unknowns is zero. So those will not enter into the equation. G and F will not be part of this equation. All right, so the torque is zero due to this point. All right, now I have to do W2, W1, and N, and I have to look at those torques. All right, it's in all cases, it's the torque given by the force times the moment arm. But, let's see, here's the axis, there's the point of application. You can see this force is at an angle, okay, to that displacement. So we need to carefully compute the force here. We can't just take this distance and multiply it times W2 to get the torque. All right, so let me draw that picture a little bigger. Here's part of my ladder. My axis is at the bottom. My weight, W2, was acting vertically, and I would like to compute that torque. So how do we compute the torque? There's a couple of ways we can do this. One way we can do this is to draw a line of action, okay, which is a line along which that force acts, and then draw a perpendicular to that line of action. So this is perpendicular. And the length of the perpendicular that I've drawn is the moment arm. So I just need to compute the torque by taking the weight. So this is the weight of the ladder, which is 355 newtons, times L. So if I once I determine L, then I can write down what that torque is. Okay, so what is the length of, what is the distance along the hypotenuse? And this W2 is the weight of the ladder. Where is this? Let's see, the ladder is 8 meters.
4 meters.
Right, the center of mass is halfway. So this is 4 meters. All right, 4 meters. Okay? All right, so let's compute the torque. Okay, we'll call this torque 1. The torque is the force times the moment arm. The force, in this case, is the weight of the ladder, is 355 newtons. And then how do I get L from this picture? Okay, so what do we know? Are there any angles in here we know? We know 50 degrees. 50 degrees is bottom. So if I want to compute from that triangle, if I know the hypotenuse is 4, the drawn angle is 50 degrees, L in this case is adjacent to the angle, so we use cosine. So 355, 4.0 times the cosine of 50. So whatever that works out, that's the torque. Okay, what is that number? We might as well compute it.
2.4.
What? 355 times 4 times the cosine of 50.
913.
All right, for now, keep those digits.
Yeah. How did you get 4 meters for the ladder?
Because the ladder is 8 meters, and the weight is concentrated at the center.
Well, how do we know? Did it say something about like a name?
It's a uniform ladder. Right? So the center of gravity is concentrated in the center, just like in the lab with a meter stick. If that were not a ladder, it were a meter stick hanging here, sitting here, right? Then the weight of the meter stick behaves, right? This acts as if the weight is at the center of mass.
So the R becomes the center of mass, like the number?
Well, 4 meters. That's where the weight of the ladder is.
Okay.
Are we all right with that? Okay. Okay, how to? Let's figure out what the torque is due to the fire person. Of course, the fire person is 6.3 meters up the ladder. So the picture looks very much the same. All I have to do is replace the 4 meters with 6.3, replace W2 with W1, and get the torque. So this is actually relatively easy once we've done the first one. It says 8.75 times what is, we replace the 4 with 6.3, and the fire person is 6.3 meters up the ladder, and multiply that again by the cosine of 50 degrees. It's the same picture. I just put different labels on. Everybody agree? Okay. What is this number? 3.5 times 10 to the third. Is that right? So I'm going to be bigger than 900. Is that right? So 3.5 times 10 to the third newtons, or 3,500 newtons. Is that right? Okay. Are those all the torques I need?
No.
No. I have one more torque up here, N. So we want to compute that torque. That's a different picture. So let's draw that. And here I have my ladder. The axis is at the bottom. N is pointing horizontal. Yes.
Isn't torque in newton meters?
Isn't torque in newton meters? Yes, it is. That's why that's newton meters. Okay. Somebody must have erased it behind that. Okay. Back to the other torque, which is also in newton meters. Okay, so I have a ladder, so just think, forget, right? This is pretty busy, so that's why I'm redrawing this, right? Here's my ladder. I have a force of the wall pushing in that direction. There's the axis. There is a force being applied at, how long is this? 8 meters this time, because that's where the force is. And I'm interested in what the torque is. Again, you can draw a line of action. What would that look like? The horizontal line, located right there. And then I need to draw a rubber line. So you draw a perpendicular. That perpendicular goes through the point below, goes through the axis. Perpendicular. That perpendicular line has a length, which is the moment arm. That's what I need for my final torque. Okay. So my third torque. We compute again. It's force times the moment arm. Force in this case is N and the moment arm, I now have to look at my picture and determine, what do we know? Let's see. What we do know is that the ladder is 50 degrees to the horizontal. So there's 50 degrees. Mm-hmm. We could either put down that this is 40, or that the one upstairs is 50. So I'll put 50 degrees upstairs. Either way is fine. Okay, now L is opposite 50. That means what? Sine? Okay, so that's N times what? A is the hypotenuse times the sine of 50 degrees. There's my third torque. Of course, the sum of the torques has to be zero, right? Well, I can't add these three numbers up and get zero, can I? What do I need to do besides just write these magnitudes? I need direction. So let's go back and attach some directions to these. Let's start off with the last one. Okay, if I have a force N acting on my ladder, right, pushing this way, that ladder, if that were the only force, what would it do? It would rotate counterclockwise, which tells me that has a sine of plus. The weight, both pictures look like this for W1 and W2. This causes the ladder to, well, the lot, right? If the wall weren't there, there would be no normal force. So what would the ladder do? It would fall, right, in a clockwise direction. So both of those are negative. Okay. Now we have all the ingredients to put this together. The sum of the torques is equal to zero. Let's add them up. The first one, minus 913. The next one, minus 3,500. The next one, plus, what is 8 times sine 50?
6.1.
You got 6.1, 6.3?
1.3.
All right, 6.13 equals 0. All right, so if I take 8 times the sine of 50, I'm being told that this is
so
correct.
We figured out N at 12:30. You don't use N in this?
No, we got G at 12:30.
Oh,
we didn't get N at 12:30. Okay. Yeah, we don't know. We know G, we don't know N, we don't know F. Yes?
Why aren't we all having friction force?
The frictional force at the bottom, you're asking why isn't this added in? Because how far is the frictional force acting from the axis? Zero. So the moment arm is zero, so the torque is zero. So that was one of the reasons why I wanted to put the axis down here, is because the torque due to F and the torque due to G are zero. Otherwise, if I put it somewhere else and computed it, I'd have the equation with more than one unknown, and just be wondering myself. Okay, by now, our trusty calculators have figured out what N is, right? 720? So, this is 720. This is a force. So that tells me that N is 720, but F is equal to N, so F is also 720. All right, so is our example. You start off writing down the conditions. The net force acting on the body has to be zero. That means there is no linear acceleration. The net torque is zero. That means there is no net angular acceleration. And in this example, we had forces that were not at 90 degrees like we did in some of the other examples, so that when we computed this, it took a little longer. All right. Well, since we know that the net torque, not equal to zero, produces no acceleration, let's see what happens when we do have a net torque if we can compute what the acceleration would be. So what we're interested in doing is going back and trying to fill in more of this table. So far we have what? X, B, A correspond to theta omega alpha. That's our table to date, right? The rest of it's blank. We're going to start filling this in. Okay. So what I'm interested in looking at is an analog to Newton's second law. Newton's second law of motion said, okay, that there's a net force, the body will accelerate, and we were able to figure out that the net force is equal to ma, right? And we use that. So now we have to find the equivalent in this case. All right, I'm going to take a very simple thing. Obviously, this is very complicated. It's not that simple. So let's assume that the bar here has no mass, okay, and that I have a mass that's sitting here. And if I keep pushing it with a particular force, I'm going to get it to start rotating, right? And if I keep up with it, I can get the angular acceleration to be non-zero, and I can stay with it and get this thing to speed up more and more. So I'd like to look at that type of an example. What we have here is a massless bar that we can imagine. We can attach a mass to it. We'll call this M. And watch that rotate around in a circle. But instead, what I'm going to do is a top view. So we're going to look at it instead of this direction. We'll look at it that way so that we can see the circle this mass goes through. All right, so the mass goes around in a circle. I want to apply a force to this mass. So there's F. We're going to continuously apply F and get this thing to have an angular acceleration. So it goes to the center, it's a circle, so we have a radius, and that's the situation. So by applying a force F to this mass, some distance away from our natural axis, then we are applying a torque. So let's compute the torque. Torque is equal to the force times the moment arm. What's the moment arm in this case? The radius. Right? R, in this picture, is perpendicular to F. Right? So that's all I need for this. Of course, we know that I'm applying a force to a mass. The other thing is that this has a tangential acceleration, right? Apply a force to a mass. So we can go to Newton's second law as we know it and write down F is equal to ma. So I could just go in here and put ma to the force. This a, as I mentioned, is the tangential acceleration. What I would like to do is relate the torque not to the tangential acceleration but to the angular acceleration. So the question is, can I rewrite tangential acceleration in terms of angular acceleration? And the answer better be yes, because we have to do that on the quiz.
R alpha.
Okay, R alpha. All right, so the tangential acceleration is just R alpha. Notice that by now you can see that the torque is proportional to the angular acceleration. With my end result here. Let's see. This tau is going to be something times alpha. What do I have here? Mr squared. That's the torque. Okay? So, in this particular case, I'm saying I apply a torque to M and I have a resulting acceleration. If I knew the mass and if I know R, right, I can figure out what the acceleration is. Okay. Or I can basically just compute the torque by mr, plug that in here, and then divide through by mr squared. Okay. What if I had two masses? then what would the story be? Well, in the case of two masses, then we could have basically something that looks like a dumbbell. Let me get this for you. And now I have two masses. And so as I apply a force to this, right? Of course, both experiencing this. So if I apply a force here, okay, I can get this to accelerate, but the idea is I'm going to apply a force there and here at the same time. So I essentially double this picture. All right, so we could have a dumbbell. Okay, so a dumbbell would consist of two masses. We could consider that on a massless rod. We have an axis, and we could ask, what happens if I apply forces to cause these both to rotate? And what do we end up with? We end up with a torque. Okay, on both masses. So the net torque, right, we end up with a force acting on this one, and if I put another one over here, there would be a force acting on that mass causing a second torque. So the net torque in this case, we could compute just like we did back here. I could have two different masses at two different distances, so I could really play games with this, right? There's M1 and M2, R1 and R2. And what I end up getting is two torques that look in this form. I have M1 R1 squared alpha plus M2 R2 squared alpha. So you can imagine if I added several more masses that we could just keep adding more of these MR squared alphas to the mix. But since these are attached, they're all going around the axis, right, with the same angular acceleration. I can factor that out, and I get M1 R1 squared plus M2 R2 squared times alpha. Again, I get something proportional to alpha. So if I have a network acting on a system of masses, I can write down that the network is proportional to alpha one more time. Okay? All right. Well, I can keep adding more and more masses. You can just imagine that instead of a dumbbell, I could have something like a meter stick. All right? I can attach this meter stick to an axis, and I can have it rotate around the axis. Every little piece of this is going to contribute an MR squared, just like that one. All right, every one of these pieces. So as I push this around, all right, and rotate it, we're going to be able to figure that if I apply a particular net torque to this meter stick, I can then determine what the acceleration is just by adding up all these bits and pieces. But the problem with doing this for a body like a meter stick is that you need calculus. All right, in fact, you can't, it's not even possible necessarily to be able to do it in the first years with calculus, you have to go a little bit further. But anyway, in general, you can compute the following. You can add all of these up depending upon your system. In the case of point masses, it's easy. It's just this form. In case of extended bodies like meter sticks and balls and things, all right, it takes a little more effort, but that's all right. We have a table we can refer to for the final value there. We're going to replace whatever we get here from any of those systems by the letter I, so that we get that the net torque acting on a system is I alpha. I is called the moment of inertia. For a point mass, we found out here that I is mr squared. Okay, for other masses, it's a little more complicated, and I'll write down a few in a minute. Okay. This form is similar to Newton's second law. Remember, Newton's second law said what? The net force is equal to ma, right? Right? The net force causes a linear acceleration. Here, the net torque causes an angular acceleration. Well, notice that all I have to do is replace m by I, and we get our equation, right? Replace the force by the torque, A by alpha. The only thing remaining is to replace m by I. So come over here. The cause of, let's see, we have the, what, inertia. We have the mass with a measure of inertia. For rotational motion, we're going to replace that mass by the moment of inertia. For the cause of acceleration, the cause of acceleration, linear acceleration with force. What's the cause of angular acceleration?
Torque.
And now the second law says, which used to read F equals ma, or the net force, is mass times acceleration. We now do the following. Take the analog to F, that's tau, the analog to m, and the analog to a, plug them in. And now we have the corresponding analog. That tells me if I can compute the torque, or if I know the torque, which normally you would get the way we've been computing torques, like down there, force times moment arm. Just go out, compute the force times the moment arm, I know what the torque is acting on the system, and if I know what the moment of inertia of the system is, then I can solve this for alpha. So that's the general idea. Okay, so that's how we're going to go through and look at some problems. Notice I've got three more quantities here. One can prove that the analogs here work pretty much in the same way. So let's finish this table. The work. What is work in the linear case? What was it? Basically, force times distance, right? So force times the distance. The work in the rotational case, I replace the force by its analog, which is tau. Replace x by its analog, which was theta. And this gives me the work that I would get in case that if I were applying a torque to an angle. So I'm doing work as I am applying a force to this and making it rotate. Okay, so if I know what the torque is, I know what angle I push it through, then I know how much work I've done. Again, this is in joules, so the units still work out. Kinetic energy. What was kinetic energy?
1/2 mv².
Question is, what's the kinetic energy of something that's rotating? Okay. Again, we can do the analog to this. The analog to mass?
Inertia.
Moment of inertia, I. Analog to V?
Omega.
1/2 i² is the kinetic energy of rotation. It takes energy to get somebody to be rotating about an axis. Finally, the momentum. T is equal to mv. What is m? The rotation it goes to I. V goes to omega. So that is going to be the angular momentum as opposed to the linear momentum. Only problem here is I don't put a P. I'm throwing in L. Okay. So those are all the analogs to the important things that we have learned over the last several chapters before we hit rotational motion. So let's play around with some of these and see what we can get. Okay. Of course, in order to do anything useful, we need to know the four I's. So let me write down below some moments of inertia. In a lot of examples that we do, we would like to make use of moment of inertia for things other than point masses. So, for example, if I were doing the discussion of applying a torque to this meter stick, okay, I would need to know what is the moment of inertia for this meter stick. It is not a point mass. Right? Very often you'll see we have balls rolling and things like that. A ball is a sphere. Okay, we would like to write down the moment of inertia for that, etc. So here's our few. Let's start off with the sphere. So let's assume that I have a sphere like this one. Okay, and let's assume that it's not moving, a friction's messing me up here, but I'm just spinning it around on an axis, right? So it rotates, right? It has a certain amount of kinetic energy of rotation, right? I cannot figure that out, so I know something about the moment of inertia. So imagine an axis about which this is spinning that goes through the center of the sphere. The moment of inertia through the center of mass of this sphere is 2/5 the mass of the sphere times the square of the radius of the sphere. Okay, this looks like mr squared, doesn't it? All right? This is the mass of the sphere times the r squared. But somewhere this 2/5 came out. Okay? So if somebody actually does the computation, again, think about a little point mass here, some distance from the axis, going around. You can compute its mr squared, pick another one, just add all those up, but you can only do that using calculus. We'll just say, there it is. Yes? For all spheres, it is 2/5 mr squared. Yes, as long as the axis goes through the center. Okay, we can also look at this. Okay, now here's a disk. Imagine this disk does not have a hole in it, all right, a slot. All right, this disk is rolling, all right, kind of reminds you of a wheel. Okay, so we can have a disk. And that disk is rolling about some axis through its center. Again, this disk has a radius r, it has a mass m, and the moment of inertia is 1/2 mr squared. So notice all these moments of inertia are mass times the distance squared with some number out front. So we just have to know what those numbers are. Okay. There's a hoop. As another example, a hoop looks more like the tire, right, where most of the mass is at the rim. So it's kind of hard to see what a hoop looks like. A hoop has all of its mass at the rim. Okay, also rotating about its center of mass. The moment of inertia for this is just mr squared. So these are some common objects. There's one more common object which we use quite a bit, and that's something like a meter stick or a rod. If we have a long, thin rod, okay, we can think about something where the cross section is very small. Okay, it doesn't even have to be circular. Okay, so we could say this meter stick, for example. If I have an axis going through the center of the meter stick and having that rotate, something, like a baton or something, right? Then, as you write, the moment of inertia for this is actually 1/12 the mass. Well, there's no radius in this case, okay? So what we have is the length of the rod squared. That's the characteristic length for something like this, right? Characteristic measure would be the length of the rod. Characteristic measure for zero, of course, would be the radius. So those are some standard type of values for the moments of inertia. Now let's look at a couple of examples which employ some of this dynamics. For example, let's take a disk. On some axle. And let's say we apply a force to that perpendicular, of course, to a radius, right? So let's say we're continuously applying a force. You could do this by wrapping a rope around it, pulling on it, right? But let's say I have a continuous force acting on here. Let's say the force is 100 newtons. Let's say this is the disk. Alright, so somehow I'm applying 100 newtons of force continuously around here, and this is going to rotate about an axis. And let's see, this has a diameter roughly 10 centimeters, actually a little bigger. So let's say it's got a radius of 5 centimeters. Alright, and this is, well, I might as well keep using this, as 1 kilogram mass. Mass is equal to 1 kilogram. So if I apply a force acting on this, right now it's at rest, I start applying that 100 newton force, it's going to begin to accelerate. So the question is, what's the angular acceleration? So you can imagine that applying several forces, getting a net torque, etc. But this is an application of the analog of Newton's second law, or Newton's second law for rotational motion. The net torque is I alpha. So how do I compute the net torque? If I apply a force on this, well, you can look at that from a side view, right? So I look on to the side, I see a force being applied at some distance r that's perpendicular. So I'm continually applying a force to this. Let's see, what is the torque then? How do I compute torque? Forget the I alpha part. How do you compute torque? Force times moment arm, right? So when I do the net torque, I do the force times the moment arm, unless, of course, we already know what the torque is. So that's just going to be F times R. And then I need the moment of inertia. This is assumed to be a solid disk. So I use the formula for a disk. This is 1/2 coming from value I gave you, the mass times R squared, where that's the radius of the disk times alpha. So that's the relationship between these. Let's see, F is given, R is given, M is given. Now it looks like the only thing I don't know is alpha. So let's solve for alpha. Alpha is equal to FR divided by 1/2 MR squared. Cleaning up a little, dividing by 1/2 is the same thing as multiplying by 2. So that's 2F over, see, one of the R's goes out, MR, is that right? So we can plug everything in. 2 times 100 divided by 1 times 5 centimeters is 0.05 meters. And what do we get? What? What about 4,000? What? Well, this is 5 times 10 to the minus 2, so we got 10 to the 4th. 2 fifths times 10 to the 4th is 4,000. So that's pretty big. Radians per second squared. Alright, so then you have to ask, did I make up a real force that will be applied to this 100 newton force, right? So, the idea is, if I know what force I'm applying, that gives me the torque. From that, I can determine the angular acceleration. Okay. So that's basically all this law tells us. That's this one right here. Net torque is equal to I off. All right, let's look at something involving energy. Okay, one of the biggest principles that we saw using energy was conservation of energy, right? Remember conservation of energy? Right, plus I don't have any frictional losses or anything like that, or I have conservative forces. Then, energy, the mechanical energy is conserved. So we want to look at energy. And I'm going to do this by way of an example. Let's go back to our favorite types of problems, inclines. Okay? I could put an object on an incline at a particular height, starting at rest, and let's say that's frictionless. So this just slides downhill. And when it gets down here, what will happen is we will take the potential energy at the top. What is the potential energy at the top? MGH. All that potential energy, stored energy, will be converted to kinetic energy at the bottom, which is what? 1/2 mv squared. Okay? So we have problems like, all right, if I know how high this is and I let go of it, I can figure out how fast it's going at the bottom using energy methods, right? Now what I want to do is replace that box by something like a ball. So we have this ball. We put it on an incline. We watch it go down. What is it doing as it's translating down, going down the hill? It's rotating. All right, so there's a certain amount of energy of rotation as well as the usual type of energy. So we have energy of rotation because this is rotating and it's also going from one point to another. Center of mass is going forward, right? It's going faster and faster as it goes down the hill. Okay. So now the question is, if I were to put my ball up here with that box, let's say they're the same mass, just so we don't have to think about mass. I let go of both of them. Which one's going to get down there first? Okay. Anybody agrees it's the ball? People are second guessing themselves now. All right, so let's ask the question. Basically, how fast is the sphere going to get down? Let's see. We know how fast it's going to get down. What would the speed be here? Square root of 2gh. So let's see if we can find out how fast the ball is moving. Okay, here's an incline. There's my ball. Let's say I have a ball of mass m and radius r. Again, this is at some height h. And then we'd like to know how fast is it moving when it goes downhill. Alright, how much energy is stored? Potential energy is mgh.
Would it become IGH?
No. Okay. No, sure. I've lifted a certain mass up. Alright, I can lift this up. It wouldn't be IGH, but I just lift this up. Doesn't matter what shape it is to lift it up. Alright, there's no rotation. Okay. Alright, how much energy does it have at the bottom? It's all kinetic energy. So the question is, what is the kinetic energy at the bottom of the hill? Well, it's translating and rotating. So there are going to be two parts. It's going to be the part where it is moving from this position to that position, a certain distance at a certain time. So you know what V is. Basically, that's, we could write that as the velocity of the center of mass. So there's a forward kinetic energy, just like we've seen before. Right? Call that the translational kinetic energy. I've used that word before. Plus, it's rotating. Turns out that there's also a rotational kinetic energy. I have to account for the energy, right? That's going into rotation. So that's going to be, from over here, 1/2 mass goes to I, V goes to omega. So that is the total kinetic energy at the bottom of the hill. Conservation of energy tells me that these should be equal, right? So let's make them equal. MGH is 1/2 MV squared plus 1/2 I omega. There is a conservation of energy, assuming there's no friction loss. Oops, can't cancel the M's out there. Okay, so there are a couple of things we can do. Let's see, what else do we know? Well, it's a sphere. We can replace I with its value for a sphere. So this is 1/2. I is 2/5. M, well, I should be using little m. I changed my m, didn't I? I changed that little m and little I. That's the easiest thing to change. So this is going to be mr squared. 2/5 mr squared is the moment of inertia of a sphere times omega squared. Well, I could cancel out the m's. I got a problem here, though, right? Somehow omega's gotten into the picture. But I can fix that by adding one more assumption, something that you might have been thinking, but we haven't listed. All right, I'm going to assume this rolls without slipping. Right? Remember rolling without slipping? Every one of these points is going to touch. Right? It's not going to jump over here. Not bouncing. Okay, so rolling without slipping. What is rolling without slipping? The condition on rolling without slipping we saw yesterday. Rolling without slipping told me that my velocity, V, my translational velocity, was related to omega. Remember, V forward is going to be equal to the tangential velocity of a point going around on the ball. The tangential velocity is just R omega. So this is my condition. V is R omega. What does that do for me? Well, that simplifies this expression a lot. We're getting close to done here. Let's see. 1/2 times 2/5 is 1/5. M. And what I have here is R squared omega squared. What is that? If I take R squared omega squared, isn't that the same as R omega squared? What is the emphasis? Which is V squared. Alright, so right there, R squared omega squared multiplied together is the same as V squared. Well, I've simplified this. This is equal to 1/2 plus 1/2 plus 1/5. What's the common denominator?
10.
So 5 plus 2, 7 times. So MGH is 7/10 mv squared. This is the value of the total energy of a rotating sphere without slipping. So that 7/10 replaces the 1/2 that we had before. Solve this for V. Right, the m's go out, bring the 10 up, I get 10 over 7 gh, square root of that. There's my answer. All right, so the question is, which one of these is bigger? The one for the sphere or the one for the box? See, 10 over 7 is bigger than 2, or not bigger than 2.
Less than 2.
It's less than 2. So therefore, box gets bigger. Okay, so let you think about that. While you're thinking about that, answer the following question. If instead of a sphere, let's say I had a disc, right, you know, like a quarter, whatever, or a hoop, sort of like the bicycle wheel that we have with all the mass on the outside. Which, if I had all three of these go down, which one would end up first, which one would end up last? Okay? Give you something to think about tonight. It's the hypotenuse, and guess what? We can relate the perpendicular distance to the hypotenuse and the phi. Versus, since that side is opposite phi, what trig function do you think it might be showing up? Sine. Right? The length of the perpendicular is r sine phi. R sine phi is in my definition of tau, isn't it? If I were actually able to measure this instead of computing things, which in some cases you are, then I can use r sine phi in my torque definition. So I could say the torque is equal to the force times, let me call this L, times L. Well, it turns out that this is so useful that L has been given a name. L is called the moment arm. Or the lever arm. Our book uses lever arm. I like to say moment arm, so either one is appropriate. But if I keep talking about moment arm and you read your book, then you say, what's lever arm? Okay, so basically the torque is the force times the moment arm. In the lab the other day, right, phi was 90 degrees, right, the moment arm was actually the distance between these two points. So if you have perpendicular forces, it's very easy to write down what the moment arm is. You don't have to think about the angle or the sine of what. You look for the moment arm, look for the force, and that's what the torque is. Okay? So, these are our definitions. All right? They're equivalent. So, torque is force times moment arm. Now, what we have to do is be able to compute the torque in different circumstances, and we will do this gradually as we start applying it. Since torque is supposed to be the analog to the force, the claim is that the net torque acting on a body could cause acceleration, right? So let's assume that we have zero net torque, so there is zero angular acceleration. And in order to do that, we could do that using some examples. And I've got listed here a couple of examples. What we're going to study right now is the equilibrium of rigid bodies. Okay, equilibrium of rigid bodies. There are two conditions for equilibrium. First off, what do I mean by equilibrium of rigid bodies? I mean there is no acceleration. No angular acceleration. There is no linear acceleration. We know from chapter 4 that in order to have no linear acceleration, the net force is zero, right? So we did equilibrium problems in that case. So we need that the sum of the forces acting on a body are zero.